Welcome to the Well-Read Podcast, a bi-weekly discussion of books and reading. I'm Anne.
And I'm Hallie.
And we're librarians with the Beaufort County Library in South Carolina. This week we are talking about reading young adult literature even when you're no longer a young adult. So, Hallie.
Yes.
I know that this is one of our favorite genres.
This is one of our favorite genres. Even though we are long past being teenagers.
Right. I feel like every week at least one of us has had a young adult book added as something that we were into.
Yes.
So what do you think it is about young adult that makes it so appealing?
I was thinking about this, obviously, because we're going to be talking about it, trying to put my finger on why, even when you're past being a teenager, you still enjoy, or many people enjoy, reading about teens in these teen books. And one of the things I think is that often with a teen book, the action starts right away, no matter what it is. There's not a lot of setup. It's just sort of, you start reading and you can get into the story very quickly,
right.
Which I think especially when people are so busy as adults with work and family and other commitments, they're sitting down to read. They maybe don't have the concentration that
right.
it can take for a lot of background and setup. And for example, the book that I'm going to talk about is what we're reading this week. In the first two pages, something major is happening. And so I think that might be part of it. And then the other thing I think is that even though you've grown in years beyond being a teenager, there's a part of everybody that still feels like a young person. And so you can still identify with a lot of those feelings that are represented in young adult literature.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, I think you definitely hit on the feeling that you just don't have a ton of time, and there's something about adult books that feels like it's more of a commitment. Like, I love reading teen books because they're just so fast-paced, and I know there are exceptions to that, but a lot of them are really exciting, and there's just a lot of, you just jump in and it's fun, and even if it's kind of a difficult talk, there's still something about that topic that feels a little bit less weighty than if you're reading an adult book about cancer or something that would be really traumatic. Then there's something about the teen version of it that feels maybe a little safer, I think. So at least when I read issues books, for some reason, that it seems like if it's a teen book, I'm all for it. But if it's an adult book, then I think, oh, this is going to be really harrowing and difficult to get through.
I think that's right too, that there's something more depressing about reading about it. Yeah, I feel like with a lot of the teen books, like you said, that deal with issues, there's still an element of hope. And that's not to paint a brush against all adult literature, because we read a lot of
right.
adult books too.
Right.
In trying to identify why so many people like reading the young adult books, I think that's part of it, is it's not all heaviness, it's not all,
right.
there are these glimmers of lightness or humor or hope or love. These major themes are being laid on top of a story of a very normal teenager. You know,
right.
it's like The Fault in Our Stars by John Green is a good example of, I remember when that first came out, that was a huge book, that's a big movie, and he said, you know, this isn't a cancer book, this is about teenagers with cancer. Like, they're still teenagers and they're still going through everything that regular teenagers do, it's just that they happen to have cancer and that might add some complications to it. So I think that's part of it too, is the heart of these books are still in dealing with the teenager issues that come up, as well as any bigger like death or illness, things like that. I think that might be part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of appeal in that, of just feeling like you're sort of stepping back into a time where things were more simplified, and you can have these big issues, but those books, they tend to not be, these characters don't have kids, there aren't these like really sad things that like go along with that,
right.
which isn't to say that these aren't sad topics,
right.
but there's something that makes it kind of easier
yeah.
to read. So.
There are some books that are just pure lightness.
Yeah.
Like being a teenager
yeah.
and having fun. And that's fun too. It's definitely escapism, those
right.
sorts of books.
Right.
And I think that's, like we said at first, that's part of the appeal, is that you're escaping from
mm-hmm.
having a job
right.
for 40 or plus hours a week
right.
and children or whatever. It's an escape, and that's part of what reading can be for a lot of people, is entertainment and escapism. I know it is for me
yeah.
often.
Yeah.
And that's part of why I like reading these books, because it reminds me of a time that was a little bit easier. You know, I didn't have as many worries. I had a very lucky childhood that I didn't have a lot of concerns beyond just sort of my little bubble of school and my social life and, you know, my family, but nothing major that I had to worry about. It takes me back to a time that is fun to think about for me and is a little bit simpler than my life is now.
Well, and I think that so much of YA deals with the first time you've experienced something, and so there's something appealing about remembering that,
yes,
that first time.
Yes.
That those first romantic feelings, or the first time you were successful in school, and they're now as adults, it's kind of, you don't get those sort of rush feelings,
right,
in that same way. And so I think that there's something really fun about, I know in some of the books I'm talking about, there are, the appeal to me was those feelings of first.
Yes.
And adults, we need those feelings.
I know.
Exactly. Do you think that, I mean, there's so many adult readers of YA books.
Yes.
Do you think that we're living in kind of a golden age of YA where there's so much good stuff out there, it crosses the age boundary?
I do think that. And I think part of it is marketing. The wonder,
yeah,
of marketing is,
definitely,
I think that there, because when I was growing up, I don't particularly recall like a YA section of the library,
mm-hmm,
or the bookstore. I mean, I'm guessing there was, but I'm not really remembering what even would have been in there. That there was certainly weren't as many options at the time. I felt like I very much went from reading children's books, like chapter books,
right,
to adult books. I don't recall there being such a big promotional,
no,
push
not
to YA. And so I think part of it is, even though those books were written, you know, like Judy Blume was writing a lot,
mm-hmm,
of the books that could fall into teen now, but I think they were marked more as either children's books or something.
Yeah.
I don't know where those fell on the spectrum.
Right. And I remember as a kid going to Borders and finding, I was really into Ammon Aldi books,
mm-hmm,
as a young adult. And those are probably a little more skewed towards kids. So they're probably like a tween,
mm-hmm,
sort of age group, and being super, super into those. But I don't remember, I know that section was sort,
yeah,
of separate from the rest of the children's section, but I feel like everything was just not really thick books. They,
mm-hmm,
were sort of classics. I remember,
mm-hmm,
that they were grouped with all of the like Anne of Green Gables books, which I was also really into.
Oh,
and yeah, they're so much fun. And they go on forever, so it's great. But I wouldn't say that those are teen books,
right,
necessarily. There didn't really seem to be, I know that they existed, but I agree that Judy Blume, even stuff like Forever,
right,
that's really a teen book,
right,
still would be lumped in with maybe for older children.
Right. Yeah, I think it was just maybe an offshoot of the children's section,
right,
more than its own distinct,
right,
area. And now, of course, YA sections are big in libraries and bookstores.
Yeah,
and
I can't imagine there being a YA section in a library. It would just be,
right,
there's,
it was just
a little corner of the children's,
exactly,
section that has some extra stuff in it.
So I think that part of it is there are probably more promotional aspects to marketing as a distinct YA,
mm-hmm,
section, and then because of that more people were reading those, looking,
right,
those up, and so because of that maybe publishers wanted more because they realized that they were selling. And so I feel like this, the past maybe 10 years or so,
mm-hmm,
YA has really developed into its own animal,
yeah,
and its own thing. And now there's even new adult, which is sort of,
right,
like older than young adult but not quite adult. It's a lot about college or right,
right,
out of college,
right,
and the issues and struggles that come along with that. That's forming, I think.
Right.
I don't think that's quite solidified yet,
yeah,
in what that is. But so I think that, yes, I to go back to your original question, I do think that this is kind of a golden age of YA, because even though The Giver by Lois Lowry would be considered YA, and that's been around for many years,
yeah,
I'm guessing at least 25,
yeah,
years or so. And so even though there are these great examples of YA, I think as an entity, YA has only existed as we know it for the last 10 or 15 years,
yeah,
probably.
And I kind of wonder if that's, even though Harry Potter is a children's book,
yeah,
I feel like the crossover of people, of it being acceptable to read things that were not for your specific age group, that sort of was the start of that, and then it just sort of branched out from there.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right, especially because the Harry Potter books, although they solidly start as children's books, they do, as the characters,
mm-hmm,
grow up, the themes get a little bit,
right,
more complicated and a little bit darker, and I think that they turned into teen books,
mm-hmm,
and you had a lot of people who started reading them as teenagers becoming adults as they,
right,
were reading the series. And so yeah, you're right, I think that probably had a big part to do with it.
It just seems like since Harry Potter, everyone is okay with reading anything that's outside,
yes,
of the adult genre.
Yes.
They're like, oh, this is, it has a fun cover. It's,
yes,
all,
it's all good. It's all good. Exactly.
Yeah.
There, it's interesting because in the past few years, because YA has become so popular for adults to read, there have been these think pieces published about how adults really shouldn't read,
right,
YA. And I don't know where people come up with these judgments about,
right,
what other people are reading. Like, first of all, it's reading. It's not going to make or break the world what anybody reads, you
right.
know, first of all. And why would I ever judge what anybody else is reading? It's just crazy to me that somebody can come and say adults shouldn't read YA.
Right.
And the argument is sort of it's too simplistic and it's not challenging enough.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the YA, in fact, one of the things I talked about today, it can be very complicated.
Right.
It can really, as much fun as it is to read in maybe the language, it can be simplistic. That doesn't mean it's not still beautiful or well written.
Right. Right.
And it doesn't mean the storylines are simple.
Right.
And so, I don't know. But I'm always like, read what you want to read.
Right. Yeah, no, everyone can read whatever they want.
Right.
That's all great. And I'm glad that there's room for all of us.
Exactly. For our purposes of this episode, we are saying that adults should
read
YA.
They should
because
read YA.
If you haven't ever read anything YA and you're an adult, there is a whole world of interesting, entertaining reads. And we have a few ideas of what those should be.
So, Allie, what was your first pick?
I'm going to start by saying this was very hard to narrow down.
I know.
Because I tried to look at it as if there were somebody that doesn't read young adult at all, what would I recommend for them to sort of be their entry point?
Right.
So I'm going to preface my selections with that. But I think we could do about 15 episodes of YA books for adults to read.
Yeah, it's
so
such
there might
a
be a follow-up. So my first pick is The Truth About Forever by Sarah Dessen. And Sarah Dessen is pretty much like the queen of contemporary realistic fiction. She has been writing for 20 years, so before teen books were as big as they are now, like we just talked about, she was writing. And she's written 12 books now, I think. It's 12. She writes typically about one every 2 years, so I think she has 12. All of her novels feature ordinary girls that you would know in real life, but yet they're not boring at all. You know, just because they're ordinary doesn't mean there's nothing interesting about them, and I think she really brings that out in her characters. And they're all going through real things, they have real feelings and situations, and typically there's a little hint of romance. Some of her books have a stronger emphasis on that than others. There's not necessarily always a happy ending though, so they're not romance books. It's not like a happily ever after, always between the female and the male love interest.
And that's really unusual.
That is unusual. And not to say that some of them don't have that, but that's not all of her
right.
books. And she has a way of writing dialogue that's really engaging, and you feel like they're real characters talking. It was really hard for me to pick just one to say this is the one that you should read. I think that she has a few that I would recommend if you're interested in reading her that you would pick up. But I went with The Truth About Forever because I feel like this is a good introduction to how she writes, the type of novel she writes, and if you enjoy this, I'm pretty sure you would like her other books, so I'll state that. The Truth About Forever is about a girl named Macy. Her father has recently passed away very suddenly, and Macy witnessed it.
Oh, yikes.
Yes. It's been probably about 6 months since the death. She is trying very hard to have kind of a quiet, controlled life. She feels like if she can just keep everything perfect and do really well in school, not cause any ripples in her life, in her household, she lives with her mom, that she can kind of remain safe. She can be enclosed in a perfect little safe world where nothing's going to get to her again. And very clearly hasn't fully grieved for the loss of her father or gone through the emotions that came along with the fact that she saw him die and that it was so sudden. So she's planning on having this kind of calm, in control summer. She's dating this guy who's very, very smart. He is planning on being the class valedictorian. Like, it's a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he has gone away to what they call brain camp, in some camp for smart kids. And she's going to stay home, and she's going to take over his part-time job at the library. And
fun,
right? But anyway, so she has a summer job that she's taken over for her boyfriend, and she has to work with these two girls who are just terrible to her. They're awful. And it's kind of boring, and they're not letting her do anything because she's brand new, and they feel like she doesn't know what she's talking about. So she's twiddling her thumbs at the library for the summer, but just, like I said, trying to keep under the radar, nothing. She practices her SAT words at night. You know, she's just very, like, in control. One day she is complaining to her boyfriend by email about her experience at the library because these girls that she has to work with are pretty terrible to her. And he responds that he doesn't think she's taking the job seriously enough and that they should maybe take a break. Because of that, it sort of throws her off kilter, and she comes into contact with a catering company that is catering a party that her mom is having. Her mom's a realtor and they're having some sort of open house. Macy comes home one day and this catering company is setting up and they are so disorganized and chaotic. And she's sort of looking at it like, this is my nightmare. I am very type A, in control personality. And she's looking at them like everything looks like it's about 2 seconds away from completely falling apart. They're helping at this party for her mom. And so she decides to help out. And the woman who owns the catering company, her name is Delia, and she is pregnant and disorganized. And she says, if you ever need a job, let me know and you can work with us. So after this email that she gets from her boyfriend, she decides she is going to work for the catering company and maybe shake her life up a little bit. And as the summer goes on, she keeps herself at first very removed from her coworkers. They're very an offbeat crew. They're a little quirky. And she sort of keeps herself separate. But as the summer goes on, she finds herself growing more comfortable around them and becoming friends with them. And particularly, there's one boy who's part of this group. His name is Wes. And she finds herself really feeling very comfortable with him at first. And he's very cute, and she thinks she recognizes that he's cute, but it's more about her feeling like she can be herself around him. They start having this very meaningful interaction where they decide to play a game of truth, which is funny because this is another book I talked about a few weeks ago where they play truth and it turned out terribly, but this is an example. So they play this game of truth where they promise each other that they can ask each other anything and they have to be honest. And it's this ongoing game that they're playing over the course of the summer, and they decide that at whatever point somebody decides not to answer the question, that person loses. And through that, she really finds herself making a connection with him and feeling like this is the first person that knows her as her instead of this facade that she puts on that she's so perfect. The way Sarah Dessen writes their relationship is so realistic and believable. It's not that sense of they saw each other across the room and instantly fell in love, which is usually not the way life works. And this is so much more believable, is that as she becomes more comfortable with herself and comfortable with him, and she's realizing that that perfect life was not working for her. At the same time that the romance is blossoming, she's also healing from the grief of losing her father. And Wes has a sad past too, and they connect over that. And so it's just a kind of a lovely story of this girl's transformation, and not a huge transformation. It's always who she was, but into a feeling more comfortable in her skin, as well as becoming friends with people that she wouldn't have ordinarily become friends with. And it's like a comfort read for me to read Sarah Dessen, because it's always, things just work out the way they should.
Yeah.
And there's something about that that is very peaceful. Like, it's the thing about that, that bad things happen in life and you get through them and good can come of that, and relationships can be healed. And the relationship that she has with her mother and her sister after her father's death is very fractured, and that can start to heal. And it's all about these family relationships and these family dynamics. And I think she just writes really, really well about real people going through real situations. And yes, they happen to be teenagers, but everybody, I think, can identify with what that would feel like. And when you feel out of control about something and you're trying to control it, the more that slips away. And this is about kind of letting go of that and letting and seeing that chaos can be helpful. The Truth About Forever by Sarah Dessen is what I would recommend for an entry into that world of Sarah Dessen. She doesn't write sequels, but characters from other books will pop up in.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, like she often writes about the same place, Lakeview, and so characters will pop up in different situations. And it's fun. It's like this little world that she's created and
you
can follow along.
That sounds really good. Sarah Dessen is my big black hole of or blank space of YA, where I've never read any of her books, and I feel like I need to get on that because I never heard anything but good things about her her books, but I just for some reason skipped over them when I started reading YA.
And this is a prime example of like being reminded of feelings that you have as a teen,
right,
and the emotions that you go through, and how, you know, one summer can, now it seems like summers go by so fast, and there's no real difference when you're working between summer and any other time of year.
I hate it.
And this is definitely, she captures that feeling of how that 3 months of a break from school can literally change your life and change what kind of person you are, who you are, and that feeling of possibility at the beginning of a summer of all these potential changes. I think she really does a good job of capturing that time of your life when you're sort of figuring out who you are and who you're going to become, and maybe recognizing that your parents are real people and they're not ideal, and they're not just your mom and just your dad. I think all of that is wrapped up in that. But I have a really hard time talking about the books I really love, describing them in a way that feels like I'm indicating why you should read it beyond just like, this is just great.
Yeah.
Just read it. And this is one where I feel like Sarah Dessen, if you're interested in teen books at all, she's one you should read. I just think that she exemplifies the best of teen literature. I really do. Okay, Anne, what's yours first?
So I picked Eleanor and Park by Rainbow Rowell, and this is a similar kind of thing where I really love this book because it sort of touches at these key moments of being a teenager and sort of developing these feelings that you'll later have a lot more of it as an adult. So the basic premise is that it's a love story between two 16-year-old misfits, and they live in Omaha, Nebraska, and it's set in 1986. So this is a world that has no social media. There aren't even CDs in this world. And so when I read it, I looked at my notes that I had written, because I write notes about books that I read because I'm a dork.
Yeah, I do too.
So, and I remember thinking it was I wasn't crazy about the fact that it was set in the 80s. And now I think I appreciate it more, having thought about it a little bit more, because to have a teen romance that doesn't involve social media is... there's something really kind of more innocent about it, I guess, and it's just really a sweet story. So I'm glad that it doesn't have all of these other influences that now, when you read realistic teen romances, that they have all of these kind of other people weighing in and other conflict that can come because of the social media aspect,
right.
And that's just not present in this book. So the two characters, Eleanor and Park. Eleanor is this new girl in school, and she has, when the book starts, she's just come back from living away from her family for a year, and her stepdad had sent her away. So she's been kicked out of her home, and now she's come back, and she's trying to kind of keep her temper in check so that she can stay and be there for her younger siblings. And Park is not a popular guy, but he's kind of a cool guy in school, and so he's not messed with at all. But he's definitely edgy because he's half Korean, and he's into indie rock, and he reads comic books, and he's got sort of this not your typical 80s jock kind of mentality about him. Yes. So they first meet when they're on the school bus on the way to school, and Eleanor is in the process of being made fun of from getting... the moment she gets on the school bus, then she doesn't have a place to sit, and these other kids are just mocking her. She stands out. She's got bright red curly hair, and she's overweight, and she is wearing men's clothes, and so she's just kind of a prime target for being picked on. So Park sees this, and since he's not really a part of that scene, he doesn't necessarily want to be friends with her at all, but he feels bad for her, and so he lets her sit next to him, but they don't talk. As the next few days or a few weeks go on, then he has he reads these comic books on his way to school, and he notices that she's reading over his shoulder. And so as he becomes aware of that, then he starts to kind of help her read by tilting the book a little bit toward her and waiting to turn the page until he's sure that she's finished. And then he starts to let her borrow them, and then they start talking, and it becomes this kind of friendship that's based on comic books, and they start talking about music, and so there's all these great 80s indie band references that are going on in this book, which, as I've been a little too young for that stuff, but my siblings were not, and so these are bands that I grew up listening to because my siblings were into these rock bands. So there's kind of these appealing little quirks that they have that they aren't necessarily finding in other people, that they're able to share with each other. So they start to build this friendship, and then it starts to become a romance. The thing that I loved so much about this book when I read it was that Rainbow Rowell is able to capture these moments of falling in love so beautifully and so perfectly, and in ways that I know I read them in other teen novels where I've kind of felt that, ooh, this is so cute kind of rush, but there's something that the way she does it that feels so real, and so because these are kind of both flawed characters and very everyday characters, they're not like the unattainable beautiful girl that the guy can't get, but then suddenly she pays attention to him. They're just regular people. So that she captures these moments of when your heart beats faster when you see someone, or when touching their hand is the greatest thing that you can imagine, or and everything they say is the most beautiful, fascinating thing that's possible to be said. She makes this into something that you sort of want to hug the book because you love it so much, but then she's also realistic about the downsides of being in a relationship. So they have a lot of misunderstandings because they come from really different backgrounds, and there are kind of possibly insurmountable things that come up that they may not have a chance because you know, it's teenage love, and there are real things that happen. And a lot of relationships and romances, and when you're an adult, don't work out, and they seem like they should, but they don't. So I really love that she was realistic about those sides of it by putting actual conflict into it instead of just sort of, they can't get along and then everything will work out in the end. So I don't want to tell too much about the conflict in the book because it will get into some spoilers, but Eleanor's family life is really difficult. And she has the strong stepfather, and her mom is kind of not wanting to face what's actually going on with the stepfather, of how badly he treats his family. And Park, even though he has a really stable family life, he still has a mixed race background, and that sort of sets him apart from his peers and makes things a little bit more difficult for him than they maybe would be otherwise. I don't want to get too much into, like I said, there are lots of conflicts, and I don't want to talk about their misunderstandings, but there's something about the way that this book is written. I felt like growing up, or when I read realistic YA since then, there have been a lot of books where it's sort of the same format, and then you just sort of insert the issue into the book, and so everyone is sort of the same character, but then it just is, this one is the cancer book, this one is the dad loses his job book. They're just kind of these similar kind of static formats. But there's something about Rainbow Rowell in her writing that she can make them feel like these very real people. And it's not an idealized setting. It's Omaha, Nebraska, so it's not some New York City childhood that so few people actually have. But I think that for me, the thing that stood out the most is that Eleanor isn't this stunningly beautiful, quirky girl that you read about or and see in lots of both movies that are geared towards teens and just movies in general. It seems like every girl right now in any format it's told from the point of view of the guy, and he is madly in love with this girl, and she's just so beautiful and so unattainable, and Eleanor is not. She's just a really regular girl. That just was mind-blowing to me. I think this was the first time I had read a book in a really long time where it was just a regular girl, and there are tons of regular women and girls out in the world that are deserving of love and attention just as much as the beautiful, unattainable girl. So I really liked that she was made into sort of the romantic heroine, and that she is sort of validated in that way. So this is a book, when I read it the first time, I stayed up all night and read it, and I cried a bunch, and I wish I could give this book to every teenage girl out there. I think it's just amazing. It is kind of crazy. Rainbow Rowell, she wrote this book, I think it came out 2014, and in the same year she came out with another book called Fangirl, and it's also just as great as Eleanor Park. So I'm convinced that she's magic.
She is magic. I love Rainbow Rowell, and she has written two adult books, and then Eleanor Park, which is teen, and then one called Fangirl, which takes place in college, so it's
sort of
straddles that line.
Yeah.
I've loved every single one. In fact, she's coming out with a new one in the fall that's fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
So she's
That's based off of Fangirl.
So. Exactly. I've loved all of her books, all for different reasons, all very different types of stories.
Yeah.
They're all very powerful in their own way.
She's so good at capturing these really small moments, but also the big moments.
Mm-hmm.
And her writing is really gorgeous, but they're also super readable.
Right.
They read really, really fast, but you feel all the feelings.
Yes.
I feel like
all of her books have sort of an overlay of melancholy about
mm-hmm.
them, or they're all a little bit bittersweet,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know why that's appealing, but
mm-hmm.
it really is. Something about that, and that grounds it in real life, too, I think,
right.
because often real life isn't just perfect, happy story, and I think that's why she really captures what real people are like
right.
and what real life is like, because there is that hint of not everything is perfect,
mm-hmm.
and it's never going to be perfect, so you make the best out of what you can.
Right.
Yeah.
But with this hope at the end.
Yes, with hope.
That's
yes.
really, really beautiful.
Yes.
So yeah, Eleanor Park by Rainbow Rowell, I would highly recommend as a good starting place in YA.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. All right, so I'm going to cheat on my next two, because
okay.
I'm not going to choose a single book. I'm going to choose book series to talk about. The next one is the Queen's Thief series by Megan Whalen Turner. And the first book is called The Thief. And you do want to start at the beginning of this series. This isn't one where you would want to jump in. Right now, there are currently 4 books out and a planned 6 in the series, I believe. Although she is not a very fast writer. The first book came out in 1997.
Holy cow.
And the most recent one came out just a year or two ago. So
wow. Be
prepared to wait. If you're somebody who wants to read a whole series, you know, wait till a whole series is published before you start reading, you might want to wait a while, because there's the long haul. She's sort of like the George R. R. Martin of YA books. And actually, I would say The Thief in our library system is cataloged as a children's book.
Okay.
And it's one of those that could go either way. I think there's nothing that grounds it in teen or children's, but as the series goes on, it becomes more complex, so you would definitely want to be considering it as a YA book, but just so you know, if you decide to read it. These are fantasy books, but I'm not somebody, I guess I don't have much of an imagination. I have a hard time with fantasy that's totally, everything is made up. I do well with fantasy where there's a lot of real world elements to it with just maybe a hint of fantasy, and that's what I would consider these. They're based in an imaginary medieval land, and in this world, the story is about Jen, who he is an accomplished thief who is in jail, and he is pulled from his cell in order to go steal a precious jewel for the king. And if he is successful, he'll win his freedom. But the process of tracking down and locating and stealing this jewel is going to be very dangerous. So obviously it's probably better than being in jail, but it's not a free shot that he's going to be able to capture it and be able to be released. He goes with some of the king's men and sets out on this journey to find it. It's all told from his perspective, and you know from the very beginning that he is an unreliable narrator, which you and I both love,
yes.
And you're always questioning, you know he's a thief, and you know he's kind of like a con man, so you're questioning the whole time whether he is telling the truth or not, like how much he could believe. And what she does really well is her writing is wonderful, and she's really adept at creating characters that are three-dimensional, so he is not this idealized version of a thief. Like, he kind of gets grouchy and hungry and irritated that he has to be on this journey with these people that he doesn't know, and as the book goes along, you realize what his flaws are, what his strengths are, but and also the people that at the beginning, the king's men, are sort of painted by him as being the enemy. And as he gets to know them better, and as you get to know them better as the reader, you recognize that they have flaws and they have strengths and they're real people too. And so that her writing is really excellent at that, at portraying people as people. Even though it, like I said, even though it's fantasy, it's very realistic in that way. There are a lot of political, this is for the whole series, and I would say as good as The Thief is, it's its own book, you would definitely want to continue on with the series. It gets better as the series goes on. The Thief is great as sort of its own little adventure story, but then as the series goes on, there are a lot of these political maneuverings and you're not quite sure who to trust, and maybe somebody that you trusted at the beginning turns into a character you can't trust and vice versa. Again, I keep going back to Game of Thrones. Like, I don't know if you read or read those books or watch that TV series, but there are characters that at the beginning you hate, and then eventually you're finding yourself sympathizing with them, and she does that the exact same way. Now, there's no sex or violence isn't like the Game of Thrones, so I'm not making that comparison, but just from the complexity of the story, and there's a lot of power plays that go on, it's sort of like that for the younger set. And that's why I think it's so appealing for adults to read, because obviously a lot of adults out there like the Game of Thrones, and this is just as intriguing as those books are, and with characters that make good choices and bad choices, and choices that are self-serving, and choices that maybe aren't for the greater good, or maybe are, and so you're constantly wondering who are allies and when alliances are shifting. I just love them. When I read the first one, I sort of took a break after that just because I thought it was good, but like I said, it wasn't the one that was the best in the series. And then at some point I picked up the second one, and when I picked up the second one, then I read the third and fourth right immediately following, which is very rare for me. Like I said, I really have to vary my reading, and it takes kind of a special book for me to be like, I have to find out what happens next. And so the books in the series are The Thief, The Queen of Atolia, The King of Atolia, and then A Conspiracy of Kings. Those are the ones that are out right now. And like I said, you do want to start with The Thief because it lays the groundwork for the rest. But I would say if it sounds intriguing to you at all, the series, that you would, even if you're not 100% in love with The Thief, that you do continue on, because the second book gets really good and gets very complicated, and there's a lot more depth, I would say, in the second books and beyond than what seemingly is on the surface of the first book. I think when you go back, maybe if I were to go back and read the first book now, I would see more there than I did when I read it. But when I read it, it just felt sort of like an adventure journey story to go find this jewel. I know we don't like when we say this, but there's a bit of a twist at the end. and that opens up the world to then continue on with the rest of the series.
That sounds really good. I actually haven't heard of that series.
Yeah, so. I don't know what sort of, I don't know if it's because it takes so long for her to write these books that it falls under the radar, but many people that I recommend this to have never heard of it. And it's really, really good because, like I said, even if you're not a huge fantasy reader, the fantasy elements aren't too heavy. So you can read, or I think it goes both ways. If you are a fantasy reader, you'll like it because there's a lot of the things about fantasy that you would like, but it shouldn't turn off people who aren't fantasy readers because
right.
it's not so heavy in the fantasy world. And it's, like I said, I don't have the imagination for some of the fantasy. Like when I read Lord of the Rings, I had a really hard time with some of that because I just couldn't picture some of the settings and the beings populating that book. But this is very much felt like it didn't necessarily need the fantasy to be a complete book, and the fantasy just added to it.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend it.
I wonder if, because it came, the first book came out kind of before the golden age of YA
mm-hmm.
that we've talked about, if it sort of is under the radar.
That could be, and that could also be why The Thief is classified as children's, because
yeah.
when it came out, that's just automatically where a book
yeah.
like that would have
yeah.
gone. Now I think they would probably all be grouped together and teen. And maybe that's the case where, at some places, I just know when I got these books from the library, the first one was, it's considered a children's novel
hmm.
in our library system.
Yeah. That is exciting. I'm always excited to hear about fantasy novels that are readable, because
yes.
I'm also not a huge fantasy person,
yeah.
but that one sounds like it'd be really
yeah.
fun. I always like when they're a little kind of set in realistic historical
yes.
fiction
yes.
settings, except fantasy.
With a twist.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All
right.
Sounds great.
What's your next one?
So my next book is called Noggin by John Corey Whaley. And this is a book I read for a book club that I do with some of my friends from grad school, where we read YA books and try to predict what's going to win the Prince Award,
oh,
which
yeah.
is the big YA award that the American Library Association puts out. So he actually won the Prince for another book, I think called When Things Come Back, or Where Things Come Back, I can't remember exactly, but he won a couple of years ago for that book. And then this one came out last year, and I actually liked this one better, but my book club did not like it at all. I was the only person that liked it. Which I thought was crazy until we talked about it, and they all really love sci-fi, and I'm not a sci-fi person, and so they got this book thinking it would be more based in sci-fi, and it's not really. There's kind of a sci-fi premise, but it doesn't have lots of technical talk. It's not, once it gets past this basic intro, then it's really not about the sci-fi side of it at all. So I loved it because it's great for someone who isn't into sci-fi. There's just enough to make it interesting and kind of a sort of altered world, but not so much that I didn't want to read it. So the premise of it, it's a 60-year-old boy named Travis, and he wakes up after having his head attached to another boy's body.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. When Travis died, he was dying of cancer, and he opted at that time to have his head cryogenically frozen and to be brought back to life potentially in the next 5 years. And so this is a world where this is possible and it seems to happen somewhat regularly. I don't think Travis is, at least I can't remember that Travis is the first person to have done this in the world, but it's obviously still kind of a miracle this happens. 5 years later, his head is attached to the body of another dying teenager, and so he's able to live again. And they don't give a lot of details about this process. It's kind of, there's some just in the first few chapters, but for the most part, that's where it's left alone. He's not really into getting into the technology of how this happens or any of the medical details. It's just sort of, it worked, let's move on. So, because the book is way more interested in how Travis is adapting to this new situation he's in. I don't remember if they give a time frame of when the book is supposed to have happened, but when he died, then social media wasn't a big thing, and now it has become this big thing. So there just are all kinds of technological changes. There are new cell phones, new tablets I don't think existed before he had died. And so there are all these things that suddenly, even though it's in a really short time frame, I think it's easy to lose sight of how quickly things have changed in the past 10 years. So he's just sort of fascinated by this. And so his parents are struggling to help him adjust to becoming a modern teenager. But the most interesting thing that's taking place is that he's still 16 in his head, and all of his friends are now 21. And so even though he wants to sort of jump right back into where things used to be, and they're obviously thrilled to see him again, everything is different now. They've matured a lot. They've gone through the grieving process, and they've rebuilt their lives into something with him not in it. Travis comes into their lives again and just wants to take everything back and start fresh and have and doesn't really think there should be any changes. So he experiences these issues with reconnecting with his best friend Kyle, who right before Travis died, Kyle told him some really personal information, and that's the last thing Travis remembers. And so he wants to jump back into that conversation and sort of find out more about what Kyle has told him. And Kyle, in his mind, has left this all behind 5 years ago and doesn't want to delve into it at all and has really moved past it. And then he has a girlfriend that he was dating when he died, and now she's 21, she's engaged to someone else, she's completely moved on, but Travis just has no interest in accepting this turn of events. So his interactions with Kate, I think, are the most interesting and frustrating parts of this book, because Travis wants everything to be back to normal, and he really can't understand why they aren't back to normal. In his head, everything is just, she should have waited for him. I guess he understands that she probably had reasons to move on, but now he's back, so he should be able to just have her back on his arm. The way that she's portrayed is really interesting, because she obviously has a really strong connection with him because they dated for a while, and she can't really blame him for the way that he's feeling, but she also is really frustrated with the way he's feeling and kind of can't deal with how immature he's being in the situation. But there's no reason for him not to be immature, because he's still a 16-year-old boy. So that development and the way they interact with each other is really, really fascinating. And I think it's a really great book for adults to read. I think it's great for teens, but I think adults in particular can really identify with that, with being able to see how someone would think as a teenager, and they've been there themselves, where they understand why someone kind of can't see the bigger picture and has these immature reactions to things. But then as adults, we understand why things can't go back the way they were. And so because we have that hindsight and the maturity to sort of understand how the world works, then I think it makes this book particularly suited for adults. And I think that there are elements that we can identify with, like the way Travis is experiencing his new body. There's sort of this analogy toward what it means to go through puberty, and your body is all changing and you don't understand it, and that's really reflected well in sort of how he suddenly he's taller than he used to be, and he's more muscular than he used to be, and he sort of feels out of sorts in his own body, and that's kind of fascinating. But I think adults also understand what it's like to leave home and maybe travel someplace or go to college and try to come back, and you want to sort of dive back into the way your life used to be before you left, and it just can't be. People have moved on, new relationships have developed, new people have come in and out. And I know for me, when I go home, then there's sort of this, wait, but that was the way it was. Of course it has to stay the same way while I was gone. And I think that this book really reflects that sort of feeling that anyone can relate to, even if we haven't had our heads frozen. So,
I see most people haven't.
Yes. So this is another book that I really had a hard time putting down. I think it's really emotionally satisfying to read, and it's really emotionally charged, but it's funny. There's a lot of really funny parts to this book, and it's really fast-paced, and there are some reveals that are very interesting. And just the way that Travis develops as a character, and you know, he's always going to be a 16-year-old boy through the course of this book, but the way he has to sort of relate to people in a new way it was just really fascinating, I think, to read. I really, really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, that sounds so good. I don't know that that sort of went by me without me recognizing that.
I don't think I got a lot of I mean, I think there was a lot of expectation for it because John Corey Whaley had won the Prince 2 years before, but I don't feel like this one got as much attention as I expected. I really enjoyed it. I think that if you're not really into sci-fi, then it has just enough to make it intriguing, but it's a little more of a realistic fiction book, I would say, versus sci-fi. I just couldn't put it down. I read it all night, so it's a really fun book.
Do you do that a lot, read books all night?
More than I should.
My last one, again, isn't just a single book. It is a trilogy this time, and it's called The Montmorency Journals by Michelle Cooper. The first book is A Brief History of Montmorency, and again, this is one you definitely want to read in order. And this is a trilogy that is unique in that each book I felt like got better than the one before.
Oh, cool.
That the first one is great in its own right, but as the story goes on and you get to know the characters better, it becomes exceptional,
mm-hmm.
I'll say. And the first one, I'll describe the first one and then just give a brief overview of where the trilogy goes. The first one takes place in 1936, and Sophie Fitz-Osborne is 16, and she lives in an island castle off the coast of England with her younger sister Henry, her cousin Veronica, and her reclusive uncle, the Mad King of Montmorency. So this is a made-up place. There is no island nation of Montmorency, but other than that, it's all real. On her 16th birthday, Sophie receives a diary, and she decides to chronicle her life on the island. Her cousin is very interested in recording the history of this place, and so she's going to chronicle daily life, and she describes the aristocratic poverty that goes along with being, you know, she's a princess, but they have no money, and their castle is falling apart, and her husband or her uncle is crazy, and what it takes to survive, you know, they have to wait for deliveries from the outside world to get food and information. You know, this is 1936 and they don't have the internet, they don't know what's going on. And so information trickles in about the Spanish Civil War and growing Nazi power, and she first feels like they're very far away. So her diary really consists more of what daily life is like, you know, her frustrations with her sister and her cousin, and her growing crush on the housekeeper's son, and just her desire to lead a normal life. Her aunt lives in London and has talked about bringing her there for a debut, and so she's looking forward to that. And so it's really more about that, and the background noise of what's going on in Europe is, she thinks, not relevant to her. And then as the story goes on, it becomes apparent that it is relevant to her, especially when two German soldiers show up on the island. They arrive by boat, and then suddenly it's like, oh wait, what is happening here? You know, there's Nazi Germany is trying to amass power and take over places, and suddenly their future is a little bit uncertain. Like I said, although it's great in its own right, and it's a complete story, like, you could read that book and be done and think, okay, that was a good story, it really develops the next two books into a chronicle of World War II. And I am such a sucker for historical fiction. I love historical fiction. And I am not somebody who liked history, really, when I was in school. But something about historical fiction and putting that personal face on these bigger issues and what an ordinary person, even if she's a princess, goes through during a war, it's very powerful to me. And what these books do so well is they show what life was like, what the loss felt like, what the heartbreak felt like, what the hope felt like, you know, what there were good days and there were bad days, and there people fall in love and people fall out of love, and the things that go on during a war are heightened because of the war, I think. Again, I have a hard time talking about books that I love, and this is a series that I absolutely love. If you have any interest in historical fiction whatsoever, I would highly, highly recommend these. These are, again, they're YA, but so appropriate for adults, because they, as the books go on and as time passes, these girls are growing up. Sophie, who starts as a 16-year-old, she really grows into an adult and becomes a capable person throughout the course of these books. And it's not all happiness and light. There's a war going on, and it's all portrayed very, very solidly. Like, they're well written and they're interesting, and they're also heartfelt is the only word I can think of. Like, you care about the characters, and it felt like you knew them by the end of the course of these books. And if you like Dodie Smith's I Capture the Castle,
that's what I kept thinking.
Yes, you will love the series. In fact, I know this is blasphemy, but I actually like these better than I liked I Capture the Castle.
Oh, wow.
I read I Capture the Castle after I read these. I should say that, I think. But I think that my expectations were really high for I Capture the Castle because a lot of people I knew said I would love it.
Yeah.
And so when I read it, I thought, well, it's good. I liked it, you know, and I can see why so many people like it. But then when I read these, I felt more involved with the characters. I'll say that. I felt more involved in the story than I felt when I captured the castle. So the books in the trilogy are, the first one is A Brief History of Montmorency. The next one is The Fitz-Osbornes in Exile. And the last one is The Fitz-Osbornes at War. And those are by Michelle Cooper.
That sounds really, really fun. I hadn't heard of those, but as you were talking about it, I kept thinking, this is I Capture the Castle.
Yes, I know, yes. Definitely similarities, but without it being a carbon copy.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the time frame is a little bit different, but the British kind of exile feel to it.
Yes.
It reminds me, too, of Coney Verity, which is another World War II story involving a British girl or two British girls.
All right, talk to me about your last one.
So my last book is The Diviners by Libba Bray.
I love this one.
I know. So The Diviners, I never reread books. Like, I mean, with a few exceptions, but it's very, very rare for me to reread a book because there are too many books to read, and I always feel like I should be reading something new. But I've read this multiple times, and every time I just love it. I love it to pieces. I could reread these books every year, probably more than once a year, and be happy. It definitely has a historical fiction element to it, but it also has this fantasy element to it, which makes it kind of just this delicious, perfect book. So the setting is 1920s, and the main character is named Evie O'Neill, and she is rambunctious and energetic, and she lives in a small town in Ohio, but she's also clairvoyant. So this is this gift that she sort of hasn't really revealed to anyone, but she's becoming aware of it in her life. The book starts where is at a party, and she is able to know information about someone by holding an object that they own in her hand, and so she can kind of read this object. And she does this as a party trick at this party in her hometown, and she finds out some secrets about a prominent member of the town. Her parents are furious with this when this information comes out, and they're threatening all kinds of things. And so she, as a result, she's given the option that she can go live with her Uncle Will, who lives in New York City. And so her parents present this as this terrible choice that she has to make, and she immediately thinks this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. Because it's the 1920s in New York, and so it's just this amazing place to be. But she plays it cool, and she pretends that she'll suffer through this, and so she goes to live with her Uncle Will. So because she has this newcomer's eye view of New York City, then we get to experience this with her. So everything she discovers is brand new and exciting and thrilling, and it's just as thrilling for the reader because this is... We're getting to live this world with her. As she's exploring the Jazz Age in New York, she's encountering all these people. So because she kind of travels through the city a lot, you get to see all of these different sections of New York City that if it were a book where she just was kind of constrained to one area, it wouldn't be nearly as much fun. But because she meets someone that's involved in the Harlem Renaissance, then you see that side of 1920s New York, and she meets a Ziegfeld girl, and so you have the flapper side of it, and there's just all these characters that come into it that really populate the world in a really, really fun way. The uncle that she's gone to live with is, he's the curator of the Museum of American Folklore, Superstition, and the Occult, and I wish more than anything that this place existed, because I would go to it a lot. It sounds so cool. And so through his work, he's asked to help the police with a series of strange murders that's happening throughout New York City. And there's kind of an occult twist to these murders. So he goes to help, and Evie somehow is taken along to help with this or to go with him. And so she's sort of torn because she knows that through her gift she could help solve this crime by touching something that the murder victim had touched. But she also is really uncomfortable with it, and she wants to keep it a secret, and her uncle doesn't know that she has this ability at this time. So she has this sort of conflict within her. And there are like five different stories that are going on throughout the book, and they sort of all they do come together at a certain point in the book, but in the meantime, there are lots of stories going on, so I'm not going to get too much into the details of all these different people. But the thing that really made this book stand out to me, besides the setting and just how much fun it is that the supernatural villain is legit scary. He's so scary. And so I bought this book, or I think I checked it out first, right when I moved to Buford. And I usually have this huge backlist of books that I'm working through. And the cover is just so appealing to this book that I saw it on the shelf when I first started at the library here. And I thought, oh, I've got to read this. This just looks like it's too interesting. And I remember reading it. I just moved into this new apartment and everything's unfamiliar, and I kept reading the book and sort of looking over the top of it because I was so scared of this villain. Libba Bray just is really, really effective with her historical details, but also creating really sinister worlds. She wrote another series called A Great and Terrible Beauty, and that is also one that has just this lush historical setting, but also a really, really dark underside to it. She's written all kinds of different types of books. She's also won a Prince Award and has written. She's just very, really varied in her writing topics. But this is my personal favorite of her books. I just can't get enough of this. So it's full of 1920s fashion. It's full of 1920s slang.
Yes, be prepared to walk around for a while saying, "Absolutely plausible."
Yeah,
that's what I did.
And I think you read the
I did the audiobook,
yeah,
which is fantastic.
It's such a fun audiobook.
Yeah.
I need to on my third reading, I probably need to do the
yes, because the sequel is coming out soon.
Yes, it's in, the second book is called Lair of Dreams, and it's actually been pushed back a few times, and it's finally coming out in August. So I think I've got a pre-order on that on Amazon, because I just am so excited about this book. It's the first book concludes, and it has a definite ending, but it leaves a lot open for more to happen. So I'm really excited to get back into this world. It's just that I can't stress how much fun this book is. Even as it's scary, and even as there are serious things that happen in it, there's something just completely delightful about it. And the setting is perfect. It's just so well done.
Yes, I would completely endorse that recommendation.
Yeah.
I loved that book. And like Anne said, I did the audiobook, and it was good. All right, should we wrap up with what we're reading this week?
Yeah. Right. So tell me about what you're reading this week.
It's called An Ember in the Ashes by Saba Tahir. And it is a YA book.
Okay.
And it is set in a fantasy world based on ancient Rome. So again, like
oh,
we
cool.
said, it's a fantasy that you and I, who have no imagination, can get behind. There are two main characters. Elias Venturius is a soldier, and he is part of a proud military family. But he dreams of escaping from his future because he is being groomed to become a ruthless killer. The group that's in power are called the Marshals, and they rule by martial law. And he is so talented at being a soldier that a select few are groomed to become what they call masks. And they get these silver masks that adhere to their faces, and they kill people, basically,
oh, wow.
is their job. So he is one person. And the book opens in one of the very first scenes with somebody who has deserted from the school where they train these people. Somebody has tried to desert, and they have found him and brought him back, and he is whipped to death. So from the beginning, you know what the stakes are, that Elias wants to escape, and if he does escape and is not successful, it means he's going to die. And then the other main character is Laya, and she is part of the Scholars, and they're a group of people who were conquered by the Martial Empire, and are treated terribly. They're not valued at all. And she's sort of laying low and going along with things until her brother is imprisoned because he has been part of a resistance among the Scholars. And so she goes to find the resistance and agrees to become a spy for them at the school where they train the marshals to become soldiers. And so just as Elias is getting ready to desert, he's about to graduate from this academy and become this professional killer. He is named as one of the four students who will be facing the trials, which is a group of dangerous and rigorous challenges which will determine who the next emperor will be. Even at that point, he's still planning on not staying, but there are these psychic holy people, I think there are 12 of them, and they sort of have the last word on everything. What they say is what guides this whole empire. And they tell him that the only way he will truly know freedom is if he undergoes the trials. He will never be free unless he partakes in these. So that's really as far as I am in the book. It's set up so I'm already foreseeing a lot of political intrigue, possible love triangle, or even a love square. There are maybe more points to this than just a triangle. Lots of action and bloodshed. I mean, from the beginning, the author does not shy away from some of the more graphic aspects of the fact that he's being trained to be a killer. It's very engaging so far, and it's gotten a lot of great reviews. What prompted me to pick it up was people said that the propulsive nature of something like The Hunger Games, which I loved The Hunger Games, I know a lot of other people do too, is evident in this book, that
you
can't put it down on one of your stay up all night reading kind of books because the action is so intense. And so far, I would totally agree with that. And the other thing is that it was originally written as a standalone novel. She wrote it just intending it for it to be its own book. But in her mind, she knew these characters so well. She knew exactly where their lives were going to go. And she said she could have written a million books about them because she knew where their lives were going to go. And because of the reception to this book and how popular it's become, there is going to be a sequel. So what I like about that is I'm not such a fan of this trilogies or the series where each book ends on a huge cliffhanger, because then I often take breaks in between when I read one book to the next in a series. And so I'm constantly forgetting right. what happened in one right. book by the time I'm thinking of the next one. So this is more like the Harry Potter model, in my opinion, of where there was kind of that overarching story, but each individual book had the story that was resolved by the end. So I'm hoping that's what's going to turn out at the end, is it feels like it's its own complete story, but then I'll be happy to continue on in the world, but I'm not going to feel that sense of, oh my gosh, I can't believe you didn't give me any answers
right.
at the end, which I, some series, particularly YA series, I feel like, that are planned as trilogies
right.
have a tendency to do that, where you end the first book and it's like the last page, you feel like you could flip to the next page and still the story would keep going,
mm-hmm.
and it, but it just ends because that's the end of the first book to lead into the second book. And
right.
this, I feel like, is going to be more of a complete story on its own.
Cool.
Anyway, it's great so far. I would highly recommend it so far, and I can only imagine I'm going to like it even more as it goes along. And that's called An Ember in the Ashes by Saba Tahir.
That sounds really cool. I really like historical fiction set in Rome, and but I think having the fantasy element
yeah.
to it makes it sound just super fun to
yes.
do something like that.
I'll let you know when I'm all done.
Yeah.
All right, what are you reading right now?
So I'm just about finished with a book called Armada by Ernest Cline, and this is one that's getting a lot of buzz. Ernest Cline came out with a book a few years ago called Ready Player One, and that was a huge bestseller, and I have not read it because it was about video games, and I don't play video games, so I didn't have any interest in it. But Hallie told me I should read it. So as a
yes,
result...
everybody should read Ready Player One.
So I still haven't read it, but when I heard that this book was coming out and the publisher was offering free copies, free advanced copies of it, I said, yes, please, I want to read this. So I got it a few weeks ago, and I'm just getting it finished and about to publish
today.
Is it today?
Think.
Oh, wow.
Today we're recording July 7th, and I think it comes out today.
Oh, wow. I thought I had another week to give it
oh,
to you.
Maybe it comes out July 14th.
I don't know that for sure. In
we
any
will
case.
Put that in the show notes.
So it's a brand new book that I think will be very popular, but it's also set in the gaming world, which I'm not a member of the gaming world at all. I realized that as much of a nerd as I am, and as much as I consider myself just super geek, that is not a world that I cross into. And I went to a conference last year where a Comic-Con was being held in the same conference center as the librarian, so it was the geekiest building in the country. A lot of librarians were so excited that this was going on and thinking, oh, I can go take pictures with these different characters, I can kind of sneak into these different sessions for this Comic-Con, and I just realized these are not my people. I am not, my level of geekiness does not extend to this world. So I don't know that I'm the perfect audience for this book, but I still thought the book was really fun. But there are definitely some elements that I didn't understand because I don't know the gaming world, I don't know a lot of video games, I don't know a lot of sci-fi, but it still has a fun adventure feel to it. So I think that you can still read it even if you're not really immersed in that same world in the way that the characters are. So the basic premise is that the main character is named Zach Lightman, and he is a super talented gamer, and he is especially good at this game called Armada, and it's a flying game that's set in a sci-fi world, and he this is what he does every night. Every time he goes home from high school, then he goes and plays this video game, and it's, I know there's a word for this type of game, but it's the kind where you play with other people at the same time across the world. One where you're interacting with live people and can play with live people versus just playing against the computers. He plays these video games and he's really immersed in the sci-fi world, and he uses this as his escapism from thinking about his future and also to avoid speculating about his dad who died when Zach was a baby. In the time that Zach has learned about his father, he has learned that his dad was very convinced of some conspiracy theories that were tied to the sci-fi world, and that the video games were being used to sort of train commoners to be able to fight in a alien war. So Zach sort of thinks this is crazy, that and is sort of embarrassed by the fact that his dad was so convinced of this and wrote so much about this and kept all these journals sort of indicating all of his theories. So Zach sees a spaceship from this video game in real life, and he thinks, oh my gosh, I'm going crazy like my dad was. And so it doesn't concern him as much that he saw the spaceship or what the spaceship means, but that he is also going crazy. So he ignores it. He decides that there's nothing to it. And the next day, an actual spaceship lands in the front of his high school, and some humans come out of it, and they say, Zach Lightman, come with us. And so he's recruited to actually fight in an alien war, because it was all true. Everything his dad had been speculating on was actually true. because he's this elite gamer, he has these skills that are just far above what most people have, then he becomes one of the elite fighters in this war as well. But the way that Zack is sort of interpreting all this information, he keeps feeling like something is off. Like the story that he's being fed by the government, by these military, these secret military groups, is just a little too much like a video game or like a sci-fi movie. So he kind of doesn't quite buy it. And so that's kind of where I need to leave it. There's more that happens, and obviously that's pretty early on in the book that all that information is told, so I don't think I'm spoiling everything. Like I said, it's if you're able to realize that there's a lot of technical talk that you're probably not going to understand, but you can just read it for an adventure story, then it would appeal to people beyond the gaming community. If you're really into gaming, you'll adore this book. I understood all the Star Wars references, but beyond that, I know there are a lot more references in there that I didn't understand, but it's just, so far it's been really fun. The sci-fi things are kind of above my head, all the technical talk, but it still has enough plot drive to it that I think it's a really fun book. So I'm excited. I have like 30 pages more to read, so I'm excited to find out what happens.
Go read it.
Yes. So that brings us to the end of our episode. Hallie, will you go over the books that you read for
sure.
The titles and authors?
I talked about The Truth About Forever by Sarah Dessen, The Queen's Thief series by Megan Whalen Turner, and the first book is The Thief, The Montmorency Journals by Michelle Cooper, and the first book there is A Brief History of Montmorency, and then the book I'm reading right now is An Ember in the Ashes by Saba Tahir.
Okay, and I read Eleanor and Park by Rainbow Rowell, Noggin by John Corey Whaley, The Diviners by Libba Bray, and Armada by Ernest Cline.
If you'd like to get in touch with us to give us feedback or a suggestion on a topic you'd like us to discuss, you can email us at wellreadpod@gmail.com or on Twitter at wellreadpodcast. Please rate and review us on iTunes or your other podcast provider of choice. Those reviews and ratings help other people find the show. Our theme music is Kitten by Poddington Bear. We keep all of our show notes at beaufortcountylibrary.org/wellread, and you can find a listing of every book we talked about in this episode there. Thank you all for listening, and happy reading!